dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has rendered incalculably important service in the course of that war, in my estimation, and that of many others, is our first guest. We are pleased to have him with us for a couple of segments, but he has been here frequently in the past to describe problems that are very much weighing on my mind, and I think on many of our listeners as well. He is Dr. James Mitchell. He is the author of a terrific book. I mean, really required reading if you're interested in this war for the free world. It's entitled Enhanced Interrogation, Inside the Minds and Motives of the Islamic Terrorists Trying to Destroy America. You've probably seen him or heard him in other media platforms. I trust that you are familiar with the work that he's done, actually helping to break and extract information from some of the most dangerous terrorists we have confronted since 9/11, including the mastermind of that terrible day, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Jim Mitchell, it is a delight to have you with us. Thank you for giving us so generously of your time to take stock of a number of things, including some of the recent developments in Europe and what they mean for us here. Thanks for joining us. Good to have you back.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Let me start with those recent terrorist attacks in the United Kingdom. They, of course, inflicted considerable harm and trauma on the people of Britain. Would you give us a sense, as you see it now, Jim, as to the motivations of those involved? Are these, as we've been told, lone wolves who have somehow, well, I don't know, either inexplicably become radicalized or are, imbued with some sort of unnameable ideology? What's actually going on there?
Yeah, I wouldn't characterize what's happening in Britain or anywhere in the UK or anywhere else in the world the way that you did in those last two comments, because one of the things that we need to remember is that the terrorists have been doing a pretty good job, the Islamists have been doing a pretty good job of promoting this idea that the Muslim community is a worldwide community, and that in Islam, as some of your listeners will know, it is a sin for a Muslim, regardless of whether they are a violent jihadist or not, to support an infidel against another Muslim, even if the Muslim who is acting incorrectly or breaking the law or whatever is in the wrong. And if you are a true believer in Islam, then you do risk on the day of judgment going to hell for supporting an infidel. So that is a piece of it that we need to take into consideration. The other thing is I think that this stuff that we're seeing in Great Britain and we're seeing even here and in some other places like Germany and Belgium, this was predicted by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in the 2004-2005 timeline. He said we would see an increase in these attacks as like-minded jihadists spread around the world, you know, went into Western democracies, supported themselves on their welfare, spread their jihadi message, and then when the time was right, rise up and attack from within, either as individuals or most likely as part of another network, even if the network is relatively small. And one of the things that I had a chance to do when I was working with the CIA was talk to Abu Zubaydah about his recruitment and his radicalization, because he didn't start off a radicalized jihadist, working hand in hand with Al-Qaeda, although he never swore bayat to UBL. He started off as a relatively normal guy. He even lived in the United States for some period of time when he was a young man. And then he got radicalized later on. And what became clear to me in talking to him was that the mere exposure to the Wahhabi religion when he was growing up made it easier for them to recruit him later in life. And the reason for that is there are two pieces of what I call malware, you know, brain malware, that are embedded in the current versions of the Quran and the Hadith that make them particularly susceptible to this. And one of those is that the Quran is the actual spoken word of Allah passed down unerringly from Allah to Gabriel to Muhammad to some terrorist sitting in a basement somewhere listening to a cleric, right? And the other piece of that malware is that it's unrestrained by historical context, that in the Quran and the Hadith and the religious writings, there is this notion that there was an open-ended commandment to spread Sharia to the whole world, to either convert, kill, enslave, or subjugate everyone. And so the task of recruiters is not to plant a bunch of bad ideas. The task, rather, is to simply convince them that the declaration of war on infidels has already been made by Allah.
Jim, there's so much there in what you've said that I want to just tease it out a little bit. And let me start with the idea of, you said at one point Islamists, and then you talked about true believers in Islam. You talked about the Wahhabi religion, the malware, as you put it, which is a very intriguing concept here. The programming, in other words. How much, based on your extensive conversations with folks like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Abu Zubaydah, how much of this is baked in to Islam itself? I use the term Sharia to try to capture this very political, military, legal program that is the malware, I would argue. But it's also considered to be the true faith, according to the authorities, as I understand it. What's your reading on all of that?
Well, my reading is, well, I'll quote Prime Minister May right after the London Bridge attack. She said we need to do a better job of spreading British values, or she may have said Western values. Well, the people who attacked and who did the Manchester attacks and most of the other attacks, those people were born and grew up in Britain, in the United Kingdom. And if by the time they're 28 or 29, they haven't been exposed to Western values, then there's something terribly wrong with their Muslim community and terribly wrong with the way that the authorities go about spreading British values. And same thing holds true for us. You know, they have this enclave. Well, I'll tell you what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed told me. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed told me that our religious freedoms was a weapon that Allah had put in place so that we could easily be defeated. He said that jihadi-minded brothers could either immigrate to the United States or be radicalized in the United States and put in place the mechanism, the means by which to do radicalization without ever breaking any of our laws, put in place a network that when triggered later on could support Islamic terror attacks without ever breaking any of our laws. And in fact, that our sense of religious freedom and our desire to have the rest of the world like us, political correctness, could all serve as a cloaking device so that those things could be put in place and protected, hidden from sight. You know, I recently was listening to a Sam Harris podcast, and he was talking to a person named Susan Hader, who was a Muslim who has become an atheist. And she said that she thought it would be a good idea in the United States to have a place where Salafists, where jihadi-minded people who were interested in talking about how good it would be to kill the Jews and how we should overcome the world and all that stuff, would have a safe place where they could have these conversations without being surveilled. That's the attitude that produces this stuff.
There's an increasing degree of discussion of that. And I think, by and large, that's what many of the mosques, not all of them in this country, but many of the mosques are right now, is safe places that are not subject to surveillance. It's a subject that I want to turn to with you when we come back. We have to pause for just a moment with Dr. James Mitchell, the author of Enhanced Interrogation: Inside the Minds and Motives of the Islamic Terrorists Trying to Destroy America. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are engaged in a very important conversation about what is animating the jihadist enemies we confront with a man who has studied the matter closely as a PhD in psychology, but also as the lead interrogator of a number of the most dangerous of the jihadists we have captured to date, including the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He is Dr. James Mitchell, the author of a terrific and really incredibly impressive book entitled Enhanced Interrogation: Inside the Minds and Motives of the Islamic Terrorists Trying to Destroy America, co-authored by Bill Harlow. Jim, you were talking about sort of the mindset of those we are confronting and the impact that our so-called political correctness has on them and on our capacity to deal with the threat that they represent. You know, I'm often inclined to suggest that whatever we call it, political correctness, multiculturalism, you know, diversity, sensitivity, what have you, our enemies call it submission. And it reinforces their expectation that they will, in fact, triumph over us because that is, as you were saying earlier, Allah's will. Is that actually operating in the minds of people like KSM, as you see it?
Well, yeah, he sees it as he told me it's a 1,000-year war, that it's actually a battle, a war of ideas, and that he realizes that what he needs to do, they can't kill all of us who currently hold ideas that are not consistent with the Salafist version of Islam. But what they can do is infect the minds of the people growing up. And they see this as a ratcheting acceptance of Sharia. And let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. One of the things he was talking about, how if they did enough of these sort of random terror attacks on soft targets, what would happen is the general populace of these Western democracies, he was talking about the United States, but he said that the general population would become so frightened, so scared, and so overwhelmed by the terror that they would just want it to end, and they would acquiesce. And in my view, you saw that in Spain after that train attack just before the election. And you also saw something similar to that after the Manchester attack.
Dr. James Mitchell is in the house, virtually at least. We're talking about the attacks in Britain and insights into the mindset of those who perpetrated them, as well as others who are also seeking our destruction. And Jim, you were talking about the extent to which the attacks in Manchester and before that in Spain actually translated into practical impact for the jihadists on the governments in question, or certainly seem to have in the case of the Brits. I just wonder, to what extent is that calculus operating as these guys engage in terrifying conduct? You seem to think there's a pretty direct connection.
Well, I think it's one of the general strategies that they use. You know, I'm not a direct conduit for them, but I spend enough time around them to know how they think. And one thing that they believe that is that if they frighten the populace enough, that they will just want it to end. And in doing so, they will acquiesce. And what I think a lot of people don't realize is that acquiescence is actually a ratcheting up of their foothold into destroying a Western democracy, because what happens is they maintain that enclave that they've created through multicultural political correctness, they start getting people elected, those people are more sympathetic to the Islamists than they are to Western democracy. And slowly, slowly, slowly over time, you actually end up in a situation where you're no longer recognized the government that you have in control of the country.
Jim, a related point is the extent to which the jihadists, as they engage in this kind of takedown, are enabled and, in fact, to a very considerable degree, empowered to perform this kind of, civilization jihad, I guess is what the Brotherhood calls it. Then it morphs into the violent kind. By their friends on the hard left, there's some pedigree here for political correctness as an instrument of the leftists, notably, Saul Alinsky and company. Do you see that as you've been interacting with some of these jihadists that they understand that they're able to make this kind of common cause, even with people who you'd think would never want to empower such folks because they'll kill feminists, they'll kill Jews, they'll kill homosexuals and the like first. And all of those are, of course, core constituencies of the left in this country, at least.
Right. Well, I think that's the primary reason it's so hard for us to wipe out. And I don't think that is lost on them. You know, when I was talking about recruitment and radicalization with the terrorists in CIA custody, most of them scoffed at the notion that we would be able to prevent it or that we could do anything about it. Because as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed told me, that the terrorists would eventually win because we didn't have the will or stomach to do what must be done to stop them, while they, on the other hand, embraced terror and violence and death more than lying. He said we have short attention spans, no appetite for conflict, and are weakened by our desire to have the world like us, and that our media, especially the media on the left, with either on purpose or without realizing it, promote their cause and champion the tearing down of the measures that kept Americans safe after 9/11. You know, he said it would promote their cause by framing the war against them as wrong and impossible to win. And I think that feeds right into that notion. This idea that multiculturalism is the way to go, that's what's presenting assimilation. You know, not teaching Western values to people in the first place during their formative years. Because as it's looked at right now, everything that has to do with the Western values is somehow evil and mean in terms of the politically correct legions. And this notion of multiculturalism, that every culture is valid and every feature of that culture is just as valid as others, that's not true.
And Jim, you're talking about something that's really critical to understanding this. It's not just that, as Theresa May has suggested, that these jihadists in the United Kingdom have not adequately understood or embraced British values, the Brits themselves have not to a considerable degree, nor have many of the rest of us in the Western civilized world. Let me ask you one quick question about this, and then we'll turn to the United States. Did you find surprising the revelation after this most recent London attack that there are as many as 23,000 jihadists in the United Kingdom that the government there is trying to keep tabs on, some considered to be very, very dangerous, some friends of those who are very, very dangerous and of an unknown intent, but worrying just the same. Is that shocking to you as it was to many of us, or not a surprise at all?
It didn't surprise me. I think one of the things that political correctness has done is kept us from recognizing the depth and the width of this threat. You know, what you've seen over the last decade or so, particularly with President Obama's lead from behind policy, is you've seen an increase in the spread of these Islamists, this violent Islamist ideology, and you've seen an increase in these terror attacks. And at the same time, you've seen an increase in the people on the left to try to hide that or downplay the danger of it because, you know, you don't want to be called an Islamophobic or you don't want to be called a racist or whatever. But this turn the other cheek idea is a one-sided suicide pact when it comes to dealing with Islamists, because their intent is to kill you.
We're going to pause for one more moment, and we'll be right back with Dr. James Mitchell, the author of Enhanced Interrogation, and an incredibly insightful observer and analyst of what we confront in the name of Sharia supremacists. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back for our final segment with Dr. James Mitchell. Jim, I want to turn to what they're trying to do to destroy America now. You've set the predicate for it nicely by talking a bit about some of the phenomena that we're seeing in countries where this process of forcing us to submit is unfortunately further advanced. Well, unfortunately for the Brits, fortunately for us. It gives us an opportunity for course corrections, and I want to ask you about the kinds of things that we ought to be doing in a moment. But first, give us sort of, from the point of view of a professional psychologist, an analysis of where we as a nation stand in this fight, how seriously afflicted we are with some of these same problems, the lack of clarity about the importance of our values and our desire to submit to political correctness and the implications for the jihad.
I have a buddy in the FBI, and we were recently talking over coffee, and he mentioned something that I had seen in the paper, and that is that there are jihadi cells in each of the 50 states of the United States. And that's troublesome to me, because it didn't used to be that way. And the reason it's become that way is because we have allowed essentially Saudi Arabia to build these Wahhabi mosques. And they use those mosques as a cover to spread this jihadi ideology. If you talk to a Wahhabist will say you have to wait for the caliph to declare war on the infidels. But the flip, the switch that they flip, the radicalization guys flip, is this notion that God has already declared this war. And I don't want to get into that. But that's what's happening, and it's happening here. And if you look at most of the things that we're doing, we're at the wrong end of that pipeline to eventually win this. You know, we're trying to disrupt their networks and capture them before they commit a crime, hopefully, you know, that we want to capture, try, jail, kill, kick out non-citizens. Well, that's all at the wrong end of that pipeline. We're playing essentially whack-a-mole, because the other end of that pipeline is still open, and we're still allowing people to come in and spread that. And I think there are really two things that we should be thinking about doing that we aren't doing. And some of this onus falls on the so-called modern clerics. And that is, we should be attacking violent Islamic ideology by attacking the myths around the origins and the direct line to God that the current ideology has. And then the second things we ought to be doing is instilling doubt in the young men who are thinking about becoming jihadists. And there's a variety of ways to do that. It's probably too complicated for this broadcast. But we need countries like Saudi Arabia to help us to some extent. And we need other countries in the Middle East to help us. So we can't cut them out completely, but we should not allow them to have a free rein to import or export their radicals to us, particularly in the form of the precursors to these terrorists.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the Saudis. Of course, the president made a major address in Saudi Arabia a couple of weeks ago. Do you see the Saudis as having an identity of interest with us at this point in dealing with this jihadist movement, whether it's the Islamic State or the Muslim Brotherhood or other elements of essentially a global jihadist movement, that they have historically done as much to underwrite and inspire and encourage as anybody, I think?
Yeah, the bind that they're in is that the Saudi royal family are apostates to the Islamists, right? And so their desire is actually to kill them. And there's a pretty good bet that if they get into Saudi Arabia and take power, the Islamists will destroy many of the artifacts that are currently associated with the Islamic religion. So they have a personal and, I think, civilizational interest in preventing this from happening, which we really have not exploited to the extent that we could. I don't think they're our – I think they truly believe that the whole world should be under Sharia law. And my experience with them is they think it's going to happen anyway, because, through the spread of immigration, you know, through the spread of these ideas. By the fact that we do very little, for example, in Saudi Arabia, it's illegal to own a Bible. It's illegal for people to get together and pray, even in their homes, right? And it's illegal
pray
to pass out Christians.
Somebody other than Allah in the approved
right.
Muslim
yeah.
tradition.
Well, for
right.
Christians to get together and pray or pass out Christian or Jewish religious material. That's how they keep that from spreading in their country. And yet we allow them to export the precursors of that horrible Islamist ideology to ours.
Let's turn to what we need to do about it. If you had the opportunity to make recommendations to the President of the United States, which I very much hope you will have an opportunity to do, what would you be saying to him about this? Well, I think of it as kind of an incubator of jihadism in our country, as in Britain, as in France, as in Germany, as in elsewhere. In the Western world, we've seen the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, and others, you know, building infrastructure for recruitment, indoctrination, training of jihadists. You've mentioned that some of the things that have been discussed and even done so far are pretty inadequate to the task. What would you be recommending at this point be done, especially as it relates to the Muslim Brotherhood and this infrastructure it's built here?
Well, I think the Muslim Brotherhood is a terrorist organization. You know, I think they should be identified as one. And I think those people who conspire with them to overthrow our government through violence, you know, should also be indicted in these criminal conspiracies. I think we should be see, there's two pieces of this thing. Again, there's the front of the pipeline and the back of the pipeline. There's all sorts of things that need to be done in the defensive side of this thing. I mean, we should be punishing those people who are funding. Without funding, these terrorist groups dry up. They just can't do it. And so so we should be treating those people who are funding these things with many more sanctions than we are. Unfortunately, the New York Times revealed how we were tracking that funding, so it made it easier for them to change and hide the way that they do that now. But we should not allow into our country these religious organizations who claim to be doing evangelistic sort of things for Islam, when in fact what they're doing is spreading radical and violent ideology. There's all sorts of things that we need to do defensively, but we need to see this not as a war against an individual terror cell. We need to approach this like we're going to try to kill the ideology. And to do that, you have to find those places where it's being incubated, and you have to sow doubt among those people who are likely to become enamored with it. And at the same time, you have to provide them with an alternative way of thinking about it. And that can't happen if they're stovepiped into an enclave where little Sharia runs that area. You know, it can't happen. They have to be exposed in their formative years to the notion that Western democracies are good. Otherwise, they won't be able to make the choice. Because, as you know, Abu Zubaydah lived in the United States. KSM got a degree in engineering from a university at the United States. It's not that they don't understand Western values. It's that their pre-exposure to the Islamic beliefs that they were exposed to in their formative years lead them to reject Western values because they don't match their worldview.
You know, James Mitchell, there's so much in what you just said that requires further discussion, but let me just leave with this final thought. I think your last point about the extent to which it serves the interests of these jihadists, of the Islamists, if you wish, the Sharia supremacists seems to me to be the optimum term, that they segregate their communities, they dominate them under their mosque structure, their Islamic societies and cultural centers and front groups and so on. This is of course, exactly what the Muslim Brotherhood has been doing in the United States for about 50 years. It's why you're right, they are a terrorist organization and ought to be rooted out. And I think more broadly, the effort to counter this phenomenon in our midst is so vitally important. Your insights, sir, from your experiences in the Air Force, retiring as a lieutenant colonel, as well as your experiences with the jihadists in the enhanced interrogation program, are incredibly valuable. And we appreciate your service to our country and look forward to talking with you again in the very near future to continue this important conversation. Thank you, Jim Mitchell. Godspeed.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is a great privilege to be joined on the Monday after a big weekend for her Act for America groups. The founder and driving force behind that organization, Brigitte Gabrielle. Brigitte, of course, is a force of nature, well known, I think, to this audience and to Americans of all stripes for her courage in standing up to and helping the rest of us push back against the kind of Sharia supremacism that we were just discussing with James Mitchell. I'm so grateful to her for taking a few minutes out of what I know is an extraordinarily busy day of after-action assessing and analyzing and reporting concerning the events that she helped organize around the United States and why. So with that, let me welcome back Brigitte Gabrielle. It's so good to have you. Thanks for taking time.
Thank you, my friend. I'm delighted to be with you.
We had a chance, as I say, to visit a bit with James about the problem that Sharia supremacism represents. Just take a minute, though, Brigitte, if you would, based on your own experience with this this odious business originally in Lebanon, as to why you think it's important for not only Act for America's teams, but the rest of us to engage against it.
Because we are seeing a rise of Sharia law in Western countries, and it's directly related to the rise of Islamic immigration and Islamic presence in these countries. And I want to make something clear, and something that you and I, Frank, make all the time, is that we are not against Muslims. There are a lot of moderate Muslims who do not want to have anything with Sharia law, anything to do with Sharia law. As a matter of fact, a lot of our rallies included Muslims, practicing Muslims who do not want to have anything to do with Sharia law. Actually, one of the organizers of one of the rallies in Atlanta was a Muslim who put the whole rally together. There are aspects of Sharia law that are not compatible with Western democracies, and that's what we're standing up against. And I saw that firsthand in Lebanon, being born and raised in what used to be a majority Christian country. Lebanon is a republic, just like the United States. And to see how Lebanon has morphed into being a hub of terrorism and terrorist activities is mind-boggling to me. I was speaking with a friend of mine a while back, and they told me that in my hometown, a Christian town that I grew up in, that now they have Muslim Sharia patrol, where they actually stopped at a girl's home in my hometown, arrested her. She's 27 years old, a Christian, by the way, took her for interrogation simply because she had a male friend come to visit her during daylight, just stop by for coffee, while her parents were not home. Who would have thought this is going to happen in a Christian town in the Middle East, where Muslims now are enforcing their religious law on Christians living in the Middle East?
So you're seeing evidence, Brigitte Gabrielle, of a similar kind of practice of this brutally repressive program. And again, as you say, not all Muslims embrace Sharia, though the authorities of the faith do. It's coming here. Give us very quickly the evidence of how that's manifesting itself in this country, as you see it.
It is manifesting itself in this country in different ways, especially within the Islamic community and especially in family law. And you, Frank, you and I have been in the trenches on this talking. As a matter of fact, I have been citing your amazing work in documenting Sharia in America in every single interview I gave in the last week. And I gave over 70 by now, because people can go to your website and are able to see how you track how many cases of Sharia law have been, and how many cases where Sharia law have been used in America instead of the Constitution? And how many states? Over 22 states, almost 30 states right now.
And Brigitte, tell us quickly about your program over the weekend. How many cities did you have people turning out to oppose this Sharia agenda, and how did it go?
Well, the advertised cities were 28 cities, but we had also other cities like Boise that were not even on our map because they came up in the last minute. So we had 29 rallies in 29 states, and we focused on the major cities, Boston, Orlando, Texas, San Bernardino, Atlanta, all of Chicago, all over the country, New York. Because we wanted to make sure we bring people out. And what this showed people is you need to act. You need to get involved. You know, I always tell people, Frank, we named the organization Act for America. Not think about America, not wish for America, not hope for America, not pray for America. You can do all the above, but without taking action, nothing happens. And I encourage people to go to actforamerica.org and get involved, become a member, join us. What this demonstration showed people on our side, Frank, is that when you come out and take a stand, they're not going to eat you. They're not going to kill you. They're not going to do anything to you. Look at the success of these rallies nationwide. We forced the nation and every single news media outlet at least to talk about the issue. Now, we operate on a shoestring budget while our opposition CARE, the terrorist organization in the United States, identified by the UAE as a terrorist organization, a front for Hamas in the United States. They've got the funding, they've got the money, they turned out people with Antifa, of course, the thugs on the radical left.
Brigitte, you've chronicled a lot of this problem in your books, including Because They Hate and They Must Be Stopped. And I just wanted to say, I commend you for your leadership in actually taking this matter to action and pulling people together. I know that this is the beginning of a very important effort. What kind of response in the end did you get? Did you get the kind of pushback and in some cases even violence that you were told was coming, or did that really not materialize?
I have to tell you, we were pleasantly surprised because we knew that Antifa, they were coming out because we were monitoring their sites. We knew what they were going to do. But thankfully, they didn't do much. It was all talk. I have to tell you, people who prayed for us and whatever they did for us and sent us their positive thoughts, something must have worked. So it was amazing. We had some clashes in certain areas, but thankfully no one got hurt, or even worse. And I'm very grateful. The rallies proved a great success. And I have to tell you, it is so empowering because we gained 250,000 members. We are up to 750,000 members right now. It is such a force and such a movement. Now we're encouraging people to join us in Washington, D.C. for our national conference. That's the next step. October 2nd and 3rd, join us in D.C. for what's going to be the most powerful national security conference happening in the country. Go to our website, actforamerica.org, for detail and join us. We're coming together to make sure elected officials understand that national security is not negotiable, not debatable. We will protect the country. This is an American issue, and everybody must do everything they can to protect our nation.
Amen. Brigitte, in our closing minute or so, I was talking with James Mitchell a moment ago, as I said, about what we should be encouraging President Trump to do. Very quickly, what would your recommendation be to him?
Designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. Secure our borders, which, of course, you know, the president is big on that. We want to support the president in enforcing his travel ban. That is very important. We need to be able to vet those who are coming into our country. And I was talking to elected officials last week, Frank, and I want to make that very clear. They're not hearing from the grassroots. They told me they're hearing from MoveOn.org. They're hearing from Indivisible. They're hearing from the radical left. They're not hearing from the grassroots. We need people to call their elected officials and make sure they tell them to stand with the president in supporting his national security policies to protect the nation.
Amen. Brigitte Gabriel, thank you so much for your extraordinary work, especially that most recently on display over the weekend. Congratulations on the further growth of your movement and the effort to help the rest of us understand why it is important that we stop this Sharia supremacist threat. Keep it up, my dear. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. In the meantime, stay well and carry on.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.